this is a briefing, and I'm going to go ahead and get us started. I know one commissioner thought that Commissioner Baker thought she might be a little bit late. So we are on to item number six, overview of protecting species with state classification. This is a briefing. Those who are new to the process, it is the role of the commission to determine conservation status of our fish and wildlife species. So this is going to be an overview on the state's authority in doing that. And I'll have our staff introduce yourselves, please.
Good morning. My name is Penny Becker, and this is Hannah Anderson, and we're with the Wildlife Programs Diversity Division. Chair Thorburn and members of the commission, we just wanted to take a little bit of time here. Those of you who are returning will remember that we've been here many times over the last couple years talking about periodic status reviews for our state-listed species, and we fielded quite a few questions as to the listing process and definitions and things like that recently. So we thought it'd be a good time, kind of an interim check on where we're at in the process and what we're using as a guideline for the listings when we bring them to you, and we'll try to be as brief as possible and get you back on track with timing. So overall, our goal for imperiled species is really to identify them and then to restore those listed species so we can get to healthy populations in their range in Washington and then really get them back off the list as quickly as possible. The process really entails we identify those species that are in need of protection and conservation. And then those species are listed through the rule that we're going to talk about a little bit just now. And then we write a recovery plan that outlines the strategies and the objectives that would get us to recovery. We implement those actions, monitor the effectiveness of those actions, and then we present a review, like the periodic status review that I just referenced. And then once we achieve those recovery objectives, then we come back to the commission with a recommendation to down or delist as we make progress. So the rule that I referred to that we use for classifying and protecting wildlife is a rule that's been around since it was approved by the commission in 1990, and it actually was one that was created with a lot of stakeholder engagement. So as you can see from the list on this slide, we've had conservation organizations, industry, federal agencies, state agencies, and interested parties from the public all involved in that process when that rule was put together. So the WAC that guides the classifying is 220-610-110, which is changed up on us now that we're not using the 232s. It always catches me off guard. So this is the new one that you should reference when we're looking at listings. And we highlighted that it's about classifying native wildlife, and those two words are pretty important, that are in need of protection and management to ensure their survival within the state of Washington. So wildlife species is actually defined as an animal species that exists in a wild state. It does not include our feral domestic animals, and it also excludes fish, shellfish, and marine invertebrates that are classified as food fish by the director. Also, another important piece of that, and we've had some discussions, especially in terms of species that often are infrequent visitors to Washington State, but the term native includes species that naturally occur here for purposes of breeding, resting, or foraging. So it doesn't depend on how much time they spend here, but if they spend that time doing those activities in Washington's waters, then there's something that we're directed to consider. The initiation of our listing and delisting process can come from a concerned member of the public, can come from WDFW staff or the Fish and Wildlife Commission. We put together a status report that essentially has all of the information about that species to determine what is the health of that population in our state. That includes a public review where anyone will have opportunity to look at those documents and to add any pertinent information. And then we bring that with a recommendation to the Fish and Wildlife Commission for your action. The criteria that the rule directs us to use says that we must look at ecological factors that are rooted in best available science. So the reasons for listing are things such as limited numbers, disease, predation factors, habitat loss, etc. And the other reason that we would recommend for a species to be listed, it says in the WAC that if the federal agencies list a species, that we should also come to the Fish and Wildlife Commission and do a complimentary suggestion for a listing to maintain that consistency. The species that we currently have on our list, there are 43, if I'm doing my math correctly, 29 of which are endangered, and those species are listed separately on one WAC and have their own protective measures. And then we have another list that is our protected list, and that list includes our threatened, sensitive species and other protected wildlife. So other protected wildlife would include species like marine mammals that are protected through the Marine Mammal Protection Act or migratory birds, things like that.
We're going to do a little tag team here, so this is where I jump in. We mentioned through that process, once it's on the list, we come and we do a periodic status review, and that's what you've been seeing us bring before you for the past couple years now. We're required to do that once every 5 years after listing, and also once the species is delisted, we would check back in 5 years to evaluate the need for a change in status. Mm-hmm. And so we've had that recent focus on completing these PSRs for all our listed species. So our delisting criteria are only when populations are no longer vulnerable, so they're no longer in danger of failing or declining, and or those recovery plan goals have been met, and it no longer meets the definitions of endangered, threatened, or sensitive. Important piece to note here is that we don't have any mechanism to remove species from the list besides recovery. So if a species becomes extirpated, for instance, it would still retain on our list. We don't have that mechanism right now. So what about the effects? So what? So species is listed, and then what happens? What are those effects? First, I want to talk about those proactive sort of non-regulatory measures. The recognition, when we list a species, it sends a strong message or rings that alarm bell that, hey, this is in trouble, and we're often the first place that occurs. When a state-listed species get a higher priority for resources, both within our agency, but also is recognized by our partners. They become available, grant sources become available, or get a higher point for having a state-listed species. We do prepare that management plan or recovery plan or conservation strategy that outlines those actions to get us to recovery. And then those actions become a priority for us and for our partners. And it's just an example. So the ferruginous hawk is a state-listed species. It does not have any federal status. And it was originally listed in 96 for habitat loss and nest site disturbance are the biggest threats. And some of those, I mentioned those enhanced available resources. One of those programs, the State Acres for Wildlife Enhancement that we have here in Washington, it's an NRCS or a farm bill. It's a voluntary farm bill program that essentially can pay landowners to create habitat, to do good things for a ferruginous hawk. And so that has become a priority action for the department, and our private lands bios deliver that opportunity to private landowners. We also have been doing statewide surveys 2 years ago now and a working group for ferruginous hawk, so really focused on, it raises that awareness. There are also regulatory measures, effects of state listing. So there are direct penalties for take in RCW, one RCW for endangered wildlife and one for the protected wildlife. When species are listed, they become a PHS species, a Priority Habitat and Species Program species, which provides our guidance to local governments, and they then incorporate our guidance into their ordinances that are required by the Growth Management Act. Listing also is a trigger for a review by the Forest Practice Board to do they need to implement a rule in forest practices or a voluntary measure for that species. What about the federal ESA? Just very quickly, there are the federal ESA also has prohibitions on take, and there's both civil and criminal penalties involved there. But there's also a big mechanism for permitting take, essentially. So the permit actions that may impact a listed species through these and other tools. And then also through the ESA, the Section 6 of the ESA is specifically focused on cooperation with the states. So we collaborate with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA to do good things for our listed species. And it's also a funding pathway for recovery actions, land transactions, land acquisition, etc. Increasingly, again, this there has been a focus on precluding the need to list. So we really don't want our species to get to the place where they need this kind of protection. And so there's a major focus on non-listed species, both non-listed in the state and by the federal agencies. And those proactive, non-regulatory approaches are both more effective and more palatable. And so that's a fisher being released right there, and we'll talk more about fisher later today. And here's another example of precluding the need to list at the state level. So we have species of greatest conservation need that have been identified through our state wildlife action plan. And in the South Sound Prairies, we have a very active group of partners that are working to restore those habitats and those species. There are 15, really more than 15 species of greatest conservation need that occur there. Some of them are listed. It does include state listed species, and four of those state listed species are federally listed. But there's another whole suite of butterflies and other animals that are using that habitat. And we're working to restore the habitat, protect the land, reintroduce those animals, monitor, research, and we really partner with a large group of folks to do that. And that's just one example, and we're working to emulate that partnership and implementation of actions throughout the state. So in summary, so we've been have had that recent focus on the bringing those PSRs. We've been through 25 of our 43 listed species has already come before you. We have 8 more in process and 5 to go. Once complete, we hope to simplify the PSR process a little bit so it's not quite so cumbersome with a big document. Even though it's a brief 10-page document, it's still a big document, and really turn our focus more to the planning and defining those actions and really getting that recovery implemented. And now we'll take your questions. You can give the hard ones to Penny.
Commissioner. Any questions? Commissioner Grable.
Of course, we're interested to learn if we make progress with any of these species. And it seems like in recent years, we've done some reintroduction efforts with the fisher. Apparently, those are doing well. I think I recall the pygmy rabbits didn't do so well when they had their first attempts. But overall, I mean, do we ever see recovery of any of these listed species? And, you know, I just can't recall ever hearing an update and saying, well, yep. Peregrine falcon.
There we go.
It's probably a good example.
We have delisted several.
Yeah.
Okay. Bald eagle is another. Peregrine falcon. Yes.
Yep.
Sure. A quick question came to mind. So the periodic status reviews are every 5 years. Some of the species, I'll take two examples, sharp-tailed grouse, pygmy rabbits, that fires have just recently just really hit them hard in terms of the remaining little circles of habitat on maps. What's the process where it's in between the status review, if catastrophic wildfires or other things really affect this species, that would come before us again to relook at it? What's the process?
The process would be the same. We don't have to wait for the periodic status review to come before you, and there's nothing that precludes us from uplisting if we would need to. So we would still present put together a status report or and there's also emergency rule. We could also come before with an emergency rule.
And then a follow up to that. So for instance, sharp-tailed grouse, the tunk fires up in my part of the woods. I mean, it took out, I don't know if we've even found them again in that one circle. And there's only about 4 circles in the state. So would you go in at this point and look at some of that? Or are you looking at it?
You will be seeing it in December.
In fact, you will be seeing it.
We actually haven't done the periodic status report on the sharp tails.
Yeah, it just went out for public comment, and we were waiting, actually, for it's been done, it's been drafted for months now, but we've been waiting for the most recent population numbers from this year. And so because we're sort of approaching the uplisting target, not target, the uplisting criteria and threshold, thank you, in the recovery plan, we didn't quite... We're still in that threatened area, and so we did not recommend an uplisting right now, but it is out for public review, so it has not been finalized.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With regard to delisting criteria and recovery plan goals, are there recovery plan goals that one could go look up and see the number for the 29 endangered and the 8 threatened and 6 threatened?
For many, yes. So there are recovery plans identified with objectives for uplisting, downlisting, delisting for many of our listed species. In some cases, we refer to the federal recovery plans, and so we don't have our own standalone state recovery plan. And some are still in, you know, we need to be developed, or they're draft or need to be developed.
Yes, Commissioner Baker.
Well, I just want to say that when I was new, Commissioner McIsaac, which wasn't very long ago, I sat down with Hannah and Penny and others and actually asked for and was provided with a series of these documents on every single animal that is listed and the plan and what we're doing. You're not very good at tooting your horn, but this is an amazing amount of work. So... that was not a question, sorry. But my question is, and this is going off of my neighbor's question, when we have an enlisted species that is endangered, that's listed, and it's all done, and you've got the piece of paper, and something terrible happens, do you guys like have an emergency unit that kicks in and does a bunch of extra stuff, or do we just kind of keep going on the way that we're going, like these fires?
Do you want to go?
I wish we did. I think what it does is it makes us go back to the table and talk about priorities and where we put our existing resources. There is no new bucket of money that usually opens up when these sorts of things happen. There are very few exceptions. The only one I can think of off the top of my head, and it doesn't have to do with the listed species, was the legislature actually did approve some one-time funding for white nose syndrome in bats, which was a new disease that we just discovered. With the exception of that, when these things happen, we're just stretching our resources in more directions.
Any other questions, commissioners? I just have a comment. I struggle very often when the periodic status report is recommending a change, usually a downlisting. While we talk about there are many things that we consider in recovery plans and that sort of thing, population status, habitat, predators, whatever is a threat. It's true in both sage-grouse and sharp-tailed grouse where we actually have specific numbers in terms of changing the listing. It's population that we look at. Our reports tie in all the threats and risks and everything, but it really is population. That's what the feds do too. And as we're looking at these struggling species now, it's so much larger than just getting down to a minimum population size. They're really habitat obligate species that we're concerned about, and it's part of the discussion that's going on with the North Rockies grizzlies, for example. That's one that's been out there. The numbers are great, but they aren't going to have any food in a few years. So I just, my comment.
Can
Yeah.
I think increasingly we're having more comments, more discussion about recovery objectives that are less centered on just population numbers for that very reason, and more focused, incorporating more the threats, the trends, because that's really, what affects them. So I agree.